Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I will face in this direction because that's where the crowd really is this afternoon. Thanks very much for joining us. My name is Tara Joseph. I'm with the Board of Governors here at the FCC. Before we get started, just a couple of quick housekeeping notes. First of all, please do remember to turn your cell phones off. Switch them back on when you leave the building later. And just to let you know about the role of speakers' lunches that we're on over the coming week, we have two more events in the next 7 days. Tomorrow we have Mr. Juan Pablo Cardinal, who's written a book called Silent Army, How China is Building Its Global Power from the Ground Up. And early next week, we have Professor Westad coming to speak about Restless Empire, China and the World Since 1750. So if you're interested in those lunches, please do sign up. I think the flyers have already gone out. Now, on to our event of the day. If you're worried about those missiles in North Korea pointing in our direction, you've come to the right place to worry and think about it today. Professor Lawrence Friedman will probably tool his talk a little bit more in that direction. The talk today is really about the pivot of the U.S. pivot to Asia and how that's being perceived in Europe. But this is also Professor Friedman's pivot to Asia. He's been very focused on Iraq, Europe, and the Falklands for many years, but he's returning to Asia to get an idea of what people are talking and thinking about here. I'd just like to make a couple of brief remarks about his background. Very, very interesting and deep indeed. He's been a professor of war studies at King's College London since 1982. He was elected a fellow of the British Academy in 1995 and awarded the CBE in 1996. He was appointed the official historian of the Falklands campaign in 1997. And he has also been appointed to serve as a member of the official inquiry into Britain and the 2003 Iraq War. So a lot of context to bring to the party here today. Professor Friedman.
Tara, thanks very much. I'm delighted to be here, honored to be here. What I'm going to do, I think, it's hard not to talk about sort of the crisis du jour of North Korea. But I wanted to give a little bit of context first in terms of sort of the advertised topic, which is American foreign policy and the Obama pivot, which isn't actually called the pivot anymore. It's now called rebalancing, which doesn't sound quite so provocative. From a European perspective, of course, the point about the pivot was not that it was to Asia, but that it was away from Europe. And you can take this as good news or bad news. You can take it as bad news in that our old allies are losing interest in us and expecting us to do more for ourselves, or good news is there's less to worry about. Actually, there's plenty to worry about in Europe, but it's not necessarily things that American security guarantees can help us much about. It's more to do with the Eurozone crisis and austerity and so on. But it's an important part of the context is a sense in Washington that the period in which the main focus of the United States had to be on European security has passed. Not necessarily a pivot away from the Middle East, Iran, Arab Israel, as we've seen from the first months of the second Obama term, are still very much major preoccupations of any American government. But the interesting part, and certainly for people, I'm sure, in this room, is the question of why Asia? And I think there's a number of things going on with American foreign policy at the moment, of which the topic that you seem to be having your next couple of speakers focusing on is clearly an important one, which is the rise of China and the implications of the rise of China. But there's two other things going on. The first is budgets, the amount of money that is being taken out of the American defense budget, even before the question of sequestration came up, the extra money that's mandated to be taken out if no new budget deal is reached between Congress and the executive, forces the Americans to think harder about priorities. And a lot of the rebalancing is not actually about a vast increase in effort and expenditure in Asia. It's more about decreases elsewhere. And indeed, if sequestration goes ahead, the Americans are going to have to think quite hard even about some of the things they're trying to do in Asia. The second thing is the aftermath of Iraq and Afghanistan. The US are out of Iraq. They'll in a year or so, they'll be largely out of Afghanistan. That's winding down. And it's clear from the whole attitude of the Obama administration, one of the reasons he got elected was the feeling that, all in all, this wasn't well handled and it wasn't very wise. And what the United States does not want to do is get itself involved in another long campaign in a divided society where Americans are not going to be particularly welcome. They'll take a lot of grief. And the problems seem extremely intractable. In a way, it's always been almost the comfort zone for the American armed forces to look for big power conflicts for which American military capabilities and traditions seem to be much more suited. So within the American defense establishment, Iraq and Afghanistan are seen almost as aberrations. This is the sort of campaign they got into in the 60s in Vietnam, and they didn't like it very much then. They got involved in it in the 2000s, and they didn't like it very much this time either. They were a bit better at it this time than they were in the 60s, but it's not what they like doing, and it's not popular at home. And you will have seen that the way that Obama prefers to deal with the terrorist threat is not by going in and getting the bad guys, but by using drones to take them out by some controller well away from the action in such a way that Americans' lives aren't put at risk and it's almost sort of surgical elimination of people who seem to be the main threat. It raises important foreign policy issues of its own, but that's the way it's being done. So if you're thinking the real purpose of the US security establishment is to be prepared not for interventions, humanitarian or otherwise, into weak states that are divided amongst themselves, but to deal with big power confrontation, then Asia's the place to be. Asia's where there are more risks, more challenges of big states who don't quite get along, who can look to the United States as playing some important role still as a source of stability and support. In this, it's important to realize that, again, despite the rhetoric of a decade ago around Afghanistan and Iraq, the United States is still basically a status quo power. The basic objective of American foreign policy is to keep things more or less as they are, with perhaps more free trade, more economic activity. But it's not really going to put a lot of effort into the business of transforming societies or forming new types of relationships. It wants the status quo is fine. And the countries which look to the United States also, by and large, like the status quo. They're comfortable with it. And so the traditional concerns of a status quo power have always been the radical powers, those who are on the up. So Germany from the late 19th century into the middle of the last century, the Soviet Union, and of course now China. So obviously part of all of this is an ambiguous relationship with China. China, and it seems to be least one of your future speakers seems to be suggesting this, is now seen as the up-and-coming great power. Its economy will see it overtaking the United States, assuming, which of course is never the case, that current rates of growth continue. It will overtake the United States in sheer size of the economy, not per capita, quite soon. Does that make it a radical challenger to the position of the United States? No. And it's just important to give a couple of reasons why that's not the case before we can look at North Korea as an illustration of some of the issues that are behind the US-China relationship. First, there's an assumption in the China's the next global power rhetoric that assumes that any country on the up wants to be a global power. Why would you? Why would you actually want to get involved in the generality of international problems? Does China really want to find itself trying to sort out the Middle East? Does China want to get involved in every squabble in Africa? Or worry about what will happen if between the Greeks and the Turks in Cyprus? It has no interest in these things. It has interest, it has economic interest, its resource, its greed for resources obviously takes it into deals with a lot of countries. But its interests are quite narrow in that. It doesn't have a view of itself having global responsibilities. It may have global interests, but not necessarily global responsibilities. And actually, if you're going to be a global power, you can't separate the two that easily. Secondly, there's an absolutely crucial difference between the United States and China. The United States has got security arrangements of one sort or another with about 70 countries. Many of these are left over from the Cold War, but as we're seeing at the moment, these combinations of treaties, alliances, and just understandings, basing agreements or whatever, are very important still. And countries look to the United States as a stabilizing force in ways they don't look to others. So part of the pivot, as it was first called, was not just push from the Americans to say, actually, we think our interests, our security interests, are going to be much more in play in Asia than Europe over the coming coming decades, but pull from the region, that more or less saying, while you've been preoccupied with Afghanistan and Iraq, you've been missing the big story. And the big story is that China may not be interested in being a global power, but it certainly is a regional power because it has big regional interests. And so concerns about the South China Seas, about the recent concern over the islands with Japan, all of these reflect anxieties within the region that as China does develop its strength and does feel its moment has come to assert its interests, its what the Russians would call around its near abroad, then if there's no balancing power around, then only trouble will ensue. So I think that is part of the background. And I think if one wasn't going to talk about North Korea today, I think the question of the islands would be pretty high on the list, because as you disentangle that issue, you've got all the questions of the war, of the lack of warmth between China and Japan, the historical rivalries, and then this dispute over islands, not particularly important islands in the great scheme of things, except islands always cause trouble. You'd be surprised how many parts of the world where the fact that the island status, precisely because it's surrounded by water, is trouble. Cyprus, we've had recently the Falklands, which I spent quite a lot of my working life on, are partly because disputes over islands are much less ambiguous than disputes elsewhere. But North Korea, which is what I now want to talk about, raises these issues and demonstrates their complexity. Obviously, the question that people are asking at the moment is, what will the North do next? How do they keep this up? At what point are they going to decide that they're not getting the response they want, and they therefore need to back down? Or is there a risk that they will escalate one step too far? And I'll say something about, well, I haven't got the answer, but I'll say something about the way this might develop. But what interests me about North Korea is the structure of the problem to start with. North Korea, everybody knows, was a creation, actually, of the Soviet army. It was created as a Stalinist outpost after the Second World War, when almost absentmindedly the Americans and the Russians agreed in the post-war settlement to divide Korea like they were dividing parts of Europe, and then work out what to do with it later. But Kim Il-sung was inserted as a to work the way that all communist leaders worked at the time, to establish a totalitarian state in the Stalinist image. And it sort of survives almost like a Stalinist theme park, as a sort of a throwback to an earlier age. The rhetoric that's used, anybody who's listened to the rhetoric of the early 50s, when the Soviets use the same sort of vituperative language, describe the running dogs of the West and so on. It's almost like old records coming back at you. So it was created in that, but while everybody else changed, including its main sponsor, China, it kept going. It didn't find a way after 1989-90 to change. Everybody else did, but North Korea didn't. And therefore was trying to keep itself in place. Not long after the end of the Cold War, it indicated that the way it wanted to go was to protect itself by developing its own nuclear capability. Clearly, this had been an issue that had been around for some time. We don't have to go into all the ways that it might have got the technology, some certainly from China, probably quite a bit from Pakistan. The missile technology left over from the Cold War. I mean, the missiles they're talking about firing are really not your modern technology. They're 1950s technology sorts of missiles, but they can still travel long distances and do damage when they get to the other end. But that's the basis of what they are trying to do. So they tried to preserve the regime as an independent entity by going the security route, not by going the economic reform route. They discovered very quickly that their nuclear program gave it leverage, that the Americans, who'd never really taken any notice of North Korea at all since the armistice of 1953, were interested in having conversations because they wanted to stop North Korea having its own nuclear program. So for a country that's actually destitute, they found a way of encouraging others to bail it out. It was a form of extortion. But you can't have it both ways. Either they want the nuclear program for their security, or they want it for bargaining purposes. But if you want it for bargaining purposes, you've got to be prepared to bargain it away. And once you've bargained it away, you can't use it to bargain again, which is what they tried to do. I mean, they had deals in which they said they would slow down, they would shut this and do that, But they couldn't quite bring themselves to end the program because as soon as they ended the program, they had no leverage left. The only other leverage they've got is the leverage of weakness. Nobody wants them to collapse because if they do, somebody else will have to pick up the pieces. So it was both South Korea, for its reasons, and China, for different reasons, don't want North Korea to collapse in such a way that it has to be completely rescued and that population integrated, probably with South Korea, in such a way as you'd create a completely new entity and possibly, like East and West Germany, a new power. I remember in the 90s, South Koreans and Japanese, actually Japanese coming over to Britain to talk about this issue. And clearly what was bothering them was the idea of a united Korea with nuclear weapons. So nobody wants it to collapse. And that's the other thing that's probably its last major bargaining point. So why the crisis at the moment? I think there's two reasons. One, the structural reason I've described. Somehow, they need to extract more bargaining power from a wasting asset. And the way they're trying to do it, I think, is to up the ante, to create a sense of crisis that will get people talking to them again and possibly give them concessions. Secondly, there's a new leader, another example of socialism in one family, with the grandson of Kim Il-sung, not at first glance the most authentic military hero, and he's got somehow to boost his credentials as a serious player. Maybe to allow him to do other things afterwards. Maybe all those years in Switzerland have made him into a closet reformer. But until he has some credibility amongst the old guard in North Korea, he's going to find it very difficult to do anything. If you want a comparable example, which is not at all hopeful, I would say young Assad, Bashar Assad. It's not a dissimilar sort of situation. Somebody who gets into a position in a supposedly socialist secular society on a dynastic basis, but doesn't really have the personal charisma and credibility to carry it off. So I think it's partly to do with that and partly to do with the need to extract extra bargaining power from a wasting asset. And this has created what to me is one of, I can't remember a crisis quite like this. I've studied many and followed many in my time. Here you have a country threatening nuclear war against the United States. Some of you may remember a book, a novel many years ago called The Mouse That Roared, about a small state in the middle of Europe, made a very good film, very good movie, a small state in the middle of Europe that realized that the countries that did seem to do well had been beaten by the United States. And therefore, if it declared war on the United States and was then beaten, it would get all sorts of American largesse to help it recover. And then it got this sort of doomsday weapon and got close to winning. But it's a bit like the mouse that roared. They've declared war, they're threatening preemptive nuclear strikes against the United States. They're telling Western ambassadors to leave Pyongyang. They're warning foreigners in South Korea to get out while it's safe. And nobody's taking the blindest bit of notice. It's like a small child having a tantrum. And they're trying to get attention to themselves, and it's not working. There's moderate, sensible responses from the South, from the Japanese. Defensive measures are being taken quite prudently. But the overall response is, we've seen this before, stay calm, they'll get over it. Now, there's obvious risks in this situation. Those of you with small children who've had tantrums will know there does come a point when they just go over the top. where the next thing they do to get attention moves them into a new area, a new sphere. And that is a danger here. A missile test that ends in the water, that's one thing. They've done that before. Something which ends possibly inadvertently on land, a bit more alarming. A clash with a fishing boat takes you into another area. When people are tense, when these things are being watched, there's always a risk of a small incident becoming much worse. And the problem for Pyongyang in all of this is they're the ones who've raised the rhetoric. So they would have to decide at this point, do they need to demonstrate that really they're restrained? Because the reason that there has been the reaction that there has been so far to all this and the scary talk from Pyongyang is because nobody really believes the North Koreans want war because they'd lose. I mean, they can do a lot of damage. They can do a lot of damage to Seoul because Seoul's in artillery range. And that's quite a frightening prospect. But they can't win. You can see these antiquated propaganda clips coming out of North Korea at the moment, which show really old-fashioned landing craft and excited soldiers waving their weapons around. They wouldn't stand a chance against the firepower that would be ranged against them just from the air if they actually tried to do something like this. It has a few small nuclear weapons, which is alarming, because even a very small nuclear weapon can do terrible things. But it can't win them a war. So it's the danger for Pyongyang is that they create a sense of crisis, not because they want a war, but because they want people to take note, possibly to get some economic concessions, possibly some political concessions. There is an accidental incident, or possibly non-accidental incident, which gets a bit out of control. And all of a sudden, they have to decide how far they take it. I think it's quite easy for the West, for the Americans, for Europeans, and particularly for South Korea and China, quite easy for them in all of this to know how to respond, but very difficult for Pyongyang. If they just let the crisis peter out, that's easy. They just say, the Americans and the South were going to attack us, and we deterred them. It's easy to get out of it if they want to, but not in the middle of an incident. The final point is to return to what I was just talking about before. What does this mean in terms of American relationship with China? I think what's important, obviously, in this is that the major source of restraint, potentially, on North Korea is from China. China keeps North Korea going. Without China, North Korea would have collapsed in complete destitution some time ago. China clearly is very unhappy with North Korea at the moment. It's not impressed by this sort of talk, and it wants the North Koreans to back down. The Americans need to work closely with the Chinese on this issue. So for all the talk about coming in, rebalancing in Asia as a way of developing a counter to the growth of Chinese power, actually when you get to particular crises and incidents, and I think this will be true not just in North Korea, but particularly with this one, the Americans need to work pretty closely with Beijing. They need to agree what each side is doing. They don't want to give any reason for North Korea to hope that they can drive a wedge between the Americans, the Chinese, the Russians, and the other members of the Security Council. So that, I think, is in the end what this incident, which I hope remains an incident, illustrates, that the Americans are still an Asian power. They're going to carry on being an Asian power, possibly more of an Asian power than a European power for some time to come. But that doesn't just mean balance of power, preparing for great war contingencies, which may not happen. It means you get involved in all sorts of crises and problems that are going on. And actually, a lot of the time, they're not going to be working counter to China, but they're going to have to work with China. And on this one, probably, it's very important that they do. Thanks very much.
Thanks for that. And you left us with a lot of questions as to what's going to happen. We have about 15 minutes for a Q&A. So if you'd like to raise your hand, there's a microphone going around. And let us know your name and where you're from if you're affiliated with an organization. Let's start over here.
Peter Bozar, retired correspondent. If the U.S. were to get drawn into a major ground conflict in the Americas, say Mexico, Venezuela, in your mind, would it be appropriate for the UK, Europe to send ground troops there to support it?
I don't think we've got any spare. So it wouldn't be very many, even if it was appropriate. I'm sure the last thing any American government would want is to get drawn into the Americas with ground forces. Fortunately, the Americas have had some pretty nasty wars, but they've been internal wars rather than between each other. So hopefully the contingency won't arise. But I think the British, French are the only European countries with really serious military capability still, and they're cutting. So I don't think the Europeans are going to be a major presence on the international scene on these sorts of issues.
Over here.
Mark Michelson, IMA Asia. Thank you very much, Professor. I want to take you up on sort of what you were talking about at the end about the U.S.'s role in Asia and about the rebalancing or the pivot and what and how substantial that's going to be. Obviously, what you've talked about, going to have to deal more with China, and you're right, I think, in a cooperative way, economically as well as politically, and these things like North Korea. But not to use very diplomatic language, but is the U.S. really walking the talk in terms of its pivot? Because when you look at, specifically the Obama administration, of course they're going to be involved, but at the same time, the president didn't go to APEC, partly because it was during the political campaign. In the State of the Union address, he mentioned Asia hardly at all. He talked about a potential free trade agreement with the EU, but not too much of Asia. They've been very slow in terms of putting people in place and in key positions, not only for Asia, but especially for Asia in the new administration. And there seems to be a lot of other things that are potentially distracting. How do you, I know this is true all the time, but how do you look at this?
We haven't actually got our new ambassador to Britain yet,
no,
either. And I think that you could argue that the European Free Trade Agreement proposals has Asia in mind. I mean, I think it's a demonstration, which is intended for Asia as much as for the Europeans. I think it actually has got China in mind. But I take your point. And I think it's partly because this is not still a foreign policy president. I mean, he sees his main tasks domestic. He's got enormous budgetary issues. There's gun control. There's deadlock. The question of executive Congress relations. There's a lot on his plate. And interestingly, the two people he's appointed to the key positions, Hagel and Kerry, are actually both traditionalists, both Atlanticists in some ways. Neither very belligerent. Which is partly why they were chosen, but with both of a lot of experience, including in this part of the world. It's a perfectly fair point to make that the president announced the pivot. How interested he is personally in it is not altogether clear. And I think this is part of a question of just trying to get the measure of the second Obama administration. Most American presidents see their first term as about getting to the second. And in the second, they believe that's when they do interesting and challenging things. I don't think Obama has got an agenda for Asia other than possibly the trade and economic partnership thing. It is a status quo agenda. It's to help stop crises developing. You can argue with Myanmar that they've done quite a bit and so on. So there are some issues around there that are of interest. But I don't think there is an agenda like you talk about the Middle East. But what that means is that the crises create the agenda. Japan and now North Korea. So the risk is for the Americans, it gets very reactive. And so for the final point, just more or less reinforce what you were saying. And I said myself that the rebalancing means that you cut less in Asia than you cut in Europe. One of the problems that if you're thinking as the PLA is your enemy, if that's how the hypothetical enemy for a future war, then the growing strength of the PLA means that some of your bases that you've had for many years no longer look quite so safe. They're in range, as it were, which is one reason why there's quite a lot more activity with Australia, which has been sort of the main area where there probably has been an increase in activity. But I think your points are perfectly fair.
If I can just sneak one question in as a follow-up, you're talking about Europe's view of the U.S. pivot to Asia. How synchronized, in your view, are the U.S. and Europe at the moment? We've been seeing images of Maggie Thatcher and Ronald Reagan a lot recently on the television. Is it getting back to those good old days in terms of synchronization?
They weren't as synchronized, actually, as people think. I mean, there's a lot of mythology created by this. You look at the record of the Falklands, and the Americans were driving Thatcher crazy because they insisted on being an honest broker between the two, rather than supporting the aggrieved against the aggressor. You had the American invasion of a Commonwealth country, Grenada, where we were sort of told rather late in the day. They had argued about sanctions over Poland. It's a myth that they were in complete lockstep. Ideologically, they were very close, but they weren't. The synchronization actually wasn't at all perfect, even in their day. Actually, it's not bad at all at the moment. On Iran, for example, Britain, France, Germany, and the United States are working pretty closely. Even on North Korea, the Europeans have been making statements to back up what the Americans have been saying. There's quite a lot of agreement on the Middle East. The problem for Europe is it's bringing less and less to the party. I mean, it's so introverted at the moment, Europe, with its own problems. Its voice is becoming much weaker. Or voices are becoming much weaker. So I think that's the difficulty the face, not in terms of actually getting agreement on policies. It's probably transatlantic relations in that sense, probably as good as they've ever been.
Hi, Sarah Stewart from AFP. You made the point earlier that the US and China need to work together more tightly on North Korea, and certainly the Chinese rhetoric does seem to be a lot stronger, particularly over the weekend, than we've seen before. It's generally agreed that China has completely lost its patience with North Korea. What do you think it's going to do now to put that into practice? I mean, as you say, they could shut North Korea down overnight. Why don't they take more concerted action? Do you think we could see something more in the next few days and weeks?
I think the Chinese have got to learn how to use the sort of power they've got. And it's part of the process of development and maturity as a great power. If this is the role, even in the Asian area, that they want to see themselves having, it isn't, it's actually, diplomacy is quite a challenging art as to how you threaten without appearing to threaten, how you offer concessions without always appearing to be offering concessions. They've got to learn how to do this. Their problem with North Korea is its weakness. The more pressure, to put pressure economically on North Korea is probably self-defeating. to put, I mean, so they haven't actually got as much leverage as you might think. And certainly, I'm sure a number of you have spoken with Chinese diplomats and they'll have given you the line. But the line I always have always got is, you think we control them, we don't. And I think that's the line they'll be taking. I think they will, what they will try to do, and this is a pure guess, is try to find some diplomatic face-saving thing for the North Koreans to help them get out of it. They'll try and they'll hold talks. They'll try to hold talks of some sort, which they will broker. That's one possibility. They'll raise their rhetoric, but I think the North Koreans know that actually they put themselves in this position where not many people can get at them. If they're not prepared to use force and they're not prepared to see the economy completely crumble, there's not a lot else you can do. But I think they'll try to do it more by giving them some face-saving way to get out of the crisis. But whether that's, how much others will play that game, I'm not sure, because there's not a lot that you can offer the North Koreans diplomatically either. It is a very unique situation.
Francis, and then we'll have time for one more.
Francis Moriarty, RTHK. I've actually got two questions I'm going to try to slip in. The first is actually kind of a follow-on to what you've just said, and maybe in a way you've answered it, but it seems to me that there's no interest in the part on anybody, really, to see North Korea go down the tubes. Its existence serves different purposes for different people. Knowing that, what actually could the Chinese do if they made a decision, we've had enough and we're going to pull the plug? That's my first question. My second question is a very different one. I think people in Hong Kong who have been subject to Margaret Thatcher's signing of the Joint Declaration, and we are still living with this, watched with a certain mix of emotions to then see Margaret Thatcher order troops into the Falklands to preserve, a few thousand UK residents or whatever they actually are, and a bunch of sheep. I think that Hong Kong people have a very mixed view. So my question is what is your own view of why she did what she did and the decision to go into the Falklands? Was it because her own self-image of being strong was what was being tested and she had to stand behind it?
No. I mean, the Falklands was before the serious work on it was 82, it was before the serious work on Hong Kong. Sovereign British territory was invaded. She was shocked when it happened. If she was extraordinarily fortunate in the timing that there was a response available. If the Argentinians had waited 6 months, there was probably very little the British could have done about it. It so happened that the Argentinians picked exactly the wrong time to invade. She discovered she had a military option. She thought the military option would give her a diplomatic outcome, but the Argentinians didn't know how to back down. I think, and it was never sold in Britain in terms, I mean, the war was described as two bald men arguing over a comb. The Falklands are not great assets, either to Argentina or Britain. I mean, maybe there's oil there and so on, but they're not enormous assets. It was about sovereign territory being invaded and trying to solve a dispute by force. So that's what it was about, sort of the law of the jungle sort of thing, rather than the islanders. I've been to the Falklands. It is very odd place because they are very British. We travel halfway around the world and it's like you've arrived in Dorset or something. It's very strange. But the, when does self-determination kick in? Does it matter if it's only 50,000, 100,000, or for 2,000 people? It's still, if the alternative is being part of a military dictatorship, it's these are very British people, then that's why it would. And I think actually it was a similar sorts of reasons behind what she did with Hong Kong. because you've got to remember she was a lawyer. And lease back arrangement with Hong Kong, which was actually one of the options that was being mooted for the Falklands, was pretty clear. So she didn't feel, I think the legal basis on both counts gave her strength as to what she was doing. On your first question, which is similar but different to the one that was there before about what would happen if China pulled the plug on North Korea, I think the question, I used to do sort of a standard article at the time of the end of the Cold War, when one of these old East European dictatorships after another fell. And it always start, in retrospect, it was inevitable. and conclude, whatever else one can say, things will never be the same again. These, we don't know how fragile North Korea is. We've really got no idea. These countries, these regimes tend to fall when they become divided amongst themselves. It won't be because of a popular uprising. It'll be because of divisions amongst the elite. That's how these countries come to an end. Because the parts of the regime lose their stomach for the fight. They can't, and that's what I think will happen. And what the Chinese may do or may know better than anybody else is what the factions are, which they're bound to be in North Korea. So that's the way it'll change. Just pulling the plug would probably could risk real chaos and real human distress. I'm not sure how well we'd cope with it. We'd be trying to get aid in because people would be starving. So I think it's a real dilemma. I think it'll be more. These regimes can't go on forever. But I think it will end because of divisions in the top rather than because of external pressure or popular change.
We've run short on time, but we did promise one more over here.
I'll make it very quick because this came along as well. Do you think there's a chance that in Japan they're discussing that if this current round doesn't just peter out, to use your phrase earlier, that they'll say our patience is run, and especially given the rather bold moves they've made in other arenas like economics and currency, that they'll say it's time for us to have a nuclear weapon, we owe it to our own people to have that?
I think this is the unspoken issue behind a lot of non-proliferation discussions. It's the issue with Iran as well. If a country develops nuclear weapons, you find it threatening, you've got one of two options, three options. The third option is to make your peace with it, accommodate it, try not to be provocative. The second is to develop your own nuclear capability. The third is to draw on the United States. So you see in the Middle East, the Saudis, the Egyptians, the Jordanians, the Emirates, all thinking about nuclear power because of Iran. These countries don't have the alliance with the United States that Japan and South Korea have. So it's always raised. Now, obviously, people talk about the particular nuclear taboo in Japan because Japan has been the only country to suffer nuclear weapons in anger. And I think for that reason, and also if Japan overtly went for a nuclear option, that would be more or less saying we're abandoning the American alliance. We're giving up on it, and they don't want to do that. But Japan is not far away from a nuclear capability. It wouldn't be very, of all the countries we may be talking about, it would be least trouble to Japan to develop a nuclear weapon if it wanted to go that way. And I suspect that's how it'll stay. I think by and large, it's best to keep the American alliance in place. It serves a lot of other purposes. It doesn't involve the quite extreme reactions there could be elsewhere in the region to any talk of a Japanese nuclear weapon. But I know that the option never quite goes away.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it on that note. It's gone past 2 o'clock. A lot of issues to talk about, a lot of answers and a lot of questions. Thank you very much for joining us, and a token of appreciation from the club. Thank you very much. If you have a couple of questions, I'm sure Professor would be happy to answer them now if you want to come up front.
Yeah, sure.